window at Lily. She was still asleep. "What happened?" Maya asked.
"Robbie."
The abusive ex. "What about him?"
"You wouldn't tell me what happened with your nanny cam, remember?"
"Right, so?"
"You came to my house. You were angry, upset. You were even suspicious of me. You wanted me to prove that I bought it."
"I remember," Maya said. "What does this have to do with Robbie?"
"He's back," she said, with tears starting to pour down. "He's been watching me."
"Whoa, slow down, Eileen."
"I got these by email."
She reached into her purse and shoved a bunch of photographs toward Maya.
"They came from an anonymous email address, of course. Untraceable. But I know. It's Robbie."
Maya started looking through them. The photos had been taken inside Eileen's house. The first three were in her den. Two had her kids, Kyle and Missy, playing on the couch. The last was just of Eileen, sweaty, a glass of ice water in her hand, wearing a sports bra.
"I'd just come home after working out," Eileen said in way of explanation. "No one was there, so I took off my shirt and threw it in the downstairs hamper."
Maya could feel the panic welling inside of her, but she kept her voice even. "The angle," Maya said, riffling through the photographs of Eileen and her children. "These photos, they were taken by your nanny cams?"
"Yes."
Maya felt her stomach plummet.
"Look at this last one."
It was a photograph of Eileen on a couch with a man Maya had never seen. They were kissing.
"That's Benjamin Baruch. We met on Match.com. It was our third date. I had him back to my place. The kids were upstairs asleep. I didn't even think twice about it. This afternoon, I get these pictures in my email."
Why hadn't Maya thought of this before? So someone hacked into...
"Not someone, Robbie. It had to be Robbie."
"Okay, so Robbie hacked into your nanny cams?" Eileen started to cry.
"I thought the cams weren't connected to the web, you know? I mean, they use an SD card. I didn't realize. It's not even that uncommon. Hacking into cameras, I mean. People do it with those FaceTime and Skype cameras, and I should have put security measures up. But I didn't know."
She stopped and wiped the tears from her face.
"I'm so sorry, Maya," she said.
"It's okay."
"I don't know what happened with your nanny cam," Eileen said. "And it's okay if you don't want to tell me. But I thought that maybe this would explain it. That maybe someone hacked in and could see you and Lily."
Maya tried to digest this new information. Right now, she couldn't figure out exactly what this news meant or if it related to her situation. Could someone have made a video of Joe in another place and uploaded it to her nanny cam? And if that was the case, so what? It had still been filmed in that room, still recorded on that couch. But was she being watched?
"Maya?"
"I didn't get any emails like this," Maya said. "No one sent me photographs." Eileen looked at her.
"What then? What happened with your nanny cam?"
"I saw Joe," Maya said. Chapter 23. Maya carried Lily upstairs and tucked her into the bed. She debated checking the back of the nanny cam to see if the Wi-Fi was on, but right now, she didn't want to tip off whoever might be watching her.
Watching her. Wow.
Talk about sounding paranoid. She and Eileen set up the Chinese in the formal dining room, far away from the possibly prying eye of the nanny cam. Maya filled her in on what she'd seen on the nanny cam, on Isabella. And then she stopped with the confessional because she was being stupid. Fact. Eileen had brought that nanny cam into her house. Maya tried to let that go, but the suspicion buzzed in her ear. She could quiet it, but it wouldn't go away. Not completely. "What are you going to do?" Maya asked. "About Robbie?"
"I gave copies of the photographs to my attorney. He said without proof, there's nothing I can do. I made sure the Wi-Fi setting was completely off. There's a company that's going to come in and make sure my network is secure."
That sounded like a pretty good plan. Half an hour later, after she had walked Eileen to her car, Maya called Shane.
I need another favor.
You can't see, Shane said, but I'm sighing theatrically.
I need someone we trust to come in and sweep my place for bugs. She explained about Eileen and the hacked nanny cam.
Do you know if yours was hacked?
He asked. No. Do you have someone who can help me?
I do, but I have to be honest. This is all sounding a little...
Paranoid? She finished for him.
Yeah, maybe.
Were you the one who called Dr. Wu?
Maya?
What?
You're not okay.
She said nothing.
Maya?
I know, she said.
Nothing wrong with needing help.
I need to get through this first.
Get through what exactly?
Please, Shane. There was a brief pause. Then,
I'm sighing again.
Theatrically?
Is there any other way? I'll come by with some guys and sweep your place in the morning.
He cleared his throat.
You armed, Maya?
What do you think?
Rhetorical question, he said. I'll see you in the morning.
Shane ended the call. Maya wasn't quite ready yet for another horror-filled night of flashbacks. Instead, Maya turned her attention toward Claire's trip to Philadelphia. Lily was still asleep. Maya knew that she should wake her daughter and change her out of the clothes she'd worn all day and give her a bath and put her in clean pajamas. The good moms would insist on that, of course, and for a moment, Maya could also see their disapproving gazes. But those other moms weren't carrying a gun and dealing with murder, were they? They didn't even get that blood-soaked worlds like hers lived side by side with theirs, neighbor to neighbor. That while they worried about arts and crafts and after-school activities and karate classes and enrichment programs, the family next door was dealing with death and terror. Was someone watching her? There was not much she could do about that right now. There were other things, important things, that had to be dealt with right away. So she put the paranoia in a box and broke out her laptop. If her house was indeed bugged, and that still seemed like overkill to her, they could also have tapped into her Wi-Fi. To be on the ridiculously safe side, she changed her home network's name and password and used a VPN, virtual private network, to browse. That would probably be enough, but who knew? She got back online and started searching for the name Andrew Burkett. Not unexpectedly, there were several, a college professor, a car salesman, a graduate student. She tried adding in other keywords and searching back in time. A few articles on Andrew's death began to pop up. A large local newspaper covered it thusly. Young Burkett Scion drowns off yacht. Buzzwords. Yacht, not boat. And of course, Scion. They had used the same term with Joe. Scion. The rich even get their own name for a descendant. She scrolled through the articles. No one knew exactly where in the Atlantic Ocean Andrew had fallen off, but that night the family yacht, Lucky Girl, had sailed across the midway point between the port of embarkation, Savannah, Georgia, and the destination port of Hamilton on the island of Bermuda. That covered a lot of ocean. According to the news reports, Andrew Burkett was last seen going out on the upper deck of the Lucky Girl at 1 a.m. on October 24th after a long night of partying with family members and classmates. He was reported missing at 6 a.m. Joe had mentioned that three of their soccer teammates from Franklin Biddle had been on board, along with his sister Caroline. Neither Burkett parent had been on board. Judith and Joseph, along with young Neil, had been waiting for them at a deluxe hotel in Bermuda. Their caretakers on the trip had been the fairly extensive cruise staff, and whoa, one name listed in the article was Rosa Mendez, Isabella's mother, who was mostly, quote, in charge of young Caroline. Maya reread the relevant sections. She mulled them over for a few moments before continuing. Andrew's body was discovered the day after he was reported missing. The cause of death in later pieces was listed as drowning. Neither foul play nor suicide was ever mentioned. Okay, now what? Maya typed in Andrew's name with the words Franklin Biddle Academy. The school's website popped up with a link to their online community for alumni. Maya clicked it and saw a drop-down menu for various class pages. She did the math in her head, figured out what year Andrew should have graduated, and clicked it. There were listings for homecoming events and an upcoming reunion, and, of course, a link to donate money to the Academy's capital campaign. On the bottom of the page was a button that read, In Memoriam. When Maya clicked it, two headshots of students appeared. They both looked so damned young, but of course, so did the kids she served with in the military. Maya again thought about those picket fences, those thin lines, those different worlds existing side by side. The young man in the photograph on the right was Andrew Burkett. Maya had never really taken the time to study her almost brother-in-law's face before. Joe wasn't one to keep old family photographs around the house, and while the Burkettes had a portrait of Andrew in one of the distant parlors, Maya had always managed to avoid paying much attention to it. In this photograph, Andrew did not look very much like his far more handsome brother, Joe. Andrew favored his mother. Maya kept looking at the young face as though there might be a clue in it, as though Andrew Burkett might even now rise from this old school portrait and demand the truth be told. That didn't happen. I'll figure it out, Andrew. I'll avenge you, too. Maya turned her gaze to the photograph of the other deceased young man. The name under the picture was Theo Mora. Theo looked to be Latino, or maybe just had darker coloring. In the photograph, he had the awkward, forced smile of, well, a high school boy posing for his school portrait. His hair looked as if it had been slicked down, but had stubbornly started to regain control. Like Andrew, he wore a jacket and school tie, though where Andrew's tie was a perfect Windsor, this boy's looked like that of a middle manager taking the late train home. The caption on top of the page read, Gone too soon, but always in our hearts. There was no other information. Maya started Googling Theo Mora. It took some time, but she finally found an obituary in a Philadelphia newspaper. No articles. Nothing else. Just a simple obituary. It listed the date of death as September 12th, which was maybe 6 weeks before Andrew toppled off that yacht. Theo Mora had been 17 when he died. The same age as Andrew. Coincidence? Maya read it again. No cause of death was listed. She tried putting the names Andrew Burkett and Theo Mora in the same search. Two Franklin Biddle Academy pages came up. One was the link to the In Memoriam listing she'd already visited. She clicked the other link and landed on the school's Varsity Sports booster page. She found an archive of all the team rosters. Maya headed to the soccer page for that year. Lo and behold, Andrew and Theo Mora had been teammates. Could two seniors in the same high school on the same soccer team, dying less than 2 months apart, be a coincidence? Sure. But when you add in the Tom Douglas payoffs, when you add in Claire driving to Philadelphia, when you add in that Tom Douglas was now missing and Claire had been tortured and murdered, no coincidence. She checked the rest of the roster. Joe, a post-grad that year, had been on the team too. No surprise, he was a co-captain. But man, that was a lot of death for one high school soccer team. She clicked another link and found a photograph of the team. Half the team was standing, half kneeling in front of them. They all looked proud and young and healthy. Maya's eyes quickly found Joe standing, again, no surprise, in the dead center. The rakish smile had been there even then. She looked at him for a moment, so damn handsome and confident, so ready to take on the world and knowing that he would always whip it, and she couldn't help but think about his ultimate fate. In the team picture, Andrew stood next to his brother, almost literally in Joe's shadow. Theo Mora was in the front row on one knee, second from the right. He still had the awkward, forced smile. Maya scanned the other faces, hoping one might be familiar. None were. Three of these other boys had been on the yacht that night. Had she ever met any of them before? She didn't think so. She moved back to the roster and printed out the names. In the morning, she could look them up and what? Call or email them, she guessed. Ask if they'd been on that yacht. See if they knew anything about what happened to Andrew, or perhaps more relevantly, how Theo Mora had died. She kept searching online, but nothing new came up. Maya couldn't help but wonder whether Claire had done something similar. Unlikely. Odds were that she had learned something from Tom Douglas, something about this damn school, and with Claire's go-right-to-the-top philosophy, she had driven down to Franklin Biddle Academy and started asking questions. Had that been what got her killed? One way to find out. The next day, Maya would take a road trip to Philadelphia. Chapter 24. Another horrible, flashback-filled night. Even in the midst of it, even while the sounds ricocheted through her skull like hot shrapnel, Maya tried to slow it down and see whether Wu was right, whether she was just having flashbacks, or if she was hearing things that she had never heard before. Hallucinations. But every time she got close, as in any sort of nocturnal voyage, the answer became smoke, elusive. The pain from the sounds grew, and so in the end, Maya just held on until morning. She woke up exhausted. She realized it was Sunday. No one would be at the Franklin Biddle Academy to answer her questions on a Sunday. Growing up, daycare was closed on Sundays. Maybe that was for the best. A soldier takes advantage of downtime. If you have a chance to rest, you do so. You let the body and mind heal whenever you can. All of this horror could wait a day, couldn't it? Maya would take the day off from death and destruction, thank you very much, and just spend a normal day with her daughter. Bliss, right? But Shane showed up at 8 a.m. with two guys who gave her a quick nod and got to work sweeping for possible listening devices or cameras. As they started up the stairs, Shane picked up the nanny cam in the den and checked the back of it.
Wi-Fi is switched off, Shane said.
Meaning?
Meaning there's no way anyone could spy on you with this, even if the technology somehow exists.
Okay.
Unless, of course, there's some kind of back way in, which I doubt. Or someone came in and switched it off because they knew we'd be checking.
That sounds unlikely, Maya said. Shane shrugged.
You're the one having your house swept for bugs, so let's be thorough, shall we?
Okay.
First question. Besides you, who has a key to this house?
You do.
Right. But I've questioned me, and I'm innocent.
Funny.
Thanks. So who else?
No one. Then she remembered. Damn.
What?
She looked up at him. Isabella has one.
And we don't trust her anymore, do we?
Not even a little.
Do you think she'd really show up again and play around with that picture frame?
Shane asked. I would say it's unlikely.
Maybe you should get some cameras and security,
he said.
At the very least, change the locks.
Okay.
So you have a key, I have a key, Isabella has a key.
Shane put his hands on his hips and let loose a long sigh.
Don't bite my head off,
he said. But?
But what happened to Joe's?
Joe's key?
Yes.
I don't know.
Did he have it with him when he,
Was murdered? Maya finished for him. Yes, he had his key on him. At least I assume he did. He usually carried a house key, like everyone else in the free world.
Did you get back his belongings?
No. The police must still have them. Shane nodded.
Okay, then.
Okay, what?
Okay, whatever. I don't know what else to say, Maya. It's so goddamn bizarre. I don't get any of this, so I'm asking questions until maybe something becomes clear. You trust me, right?
With my life.
Yet, Shane said, you won't tell me what's going on.
I am telling you what's going on. Shane turned, looked at himself in the mirror, and narrowed his eyes. What are you doing? She asked.
Seeing if I really look that dumb.
Shane turned back to her.
Why were you asking me about that Coast Guard guy? What the hell does Andrew Burkett, who died in high school, have to do with any of this?
She hesitated.
Maya?
I don't know yet, she said. But there could be a connection.
Between what? Are you saying that Andrew's death on the boat has something to do with Joe's murder in Central Park?
I'm saying I don't know yet.
So what's your next step?
Shane asked. Today?
Yes.
Tears almost came to her eyes, but she kept them in check. Nothing, Shane.
Okay,
nothing. It's Sunday. I'm grateful you guys came over, but here's what I want to happen. I want you guys to finish sweeping this place. Then I want you all to leave so on this gorgeous autumn Sunday I can take my daughter out for a classic, cliche-ridden mommy-daughter day.
For real?
Yes, Shane. For real. Shane smiled.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Where are you two going to go?
To Chester.
Apple picking?
Maya nodded.
My parents used to take me there,
Shane said with a lilt in his voice. You want to come?
No,
he said in the gentlest voice she had ever heard.
And you're right. It's Sunday. We'll speed this up and get out of here. You get Lily ready.
They finished up, found no bugs, and with a kiss on the cheek, Shane was gone. Maya packed Lily into her car seat and started the day. Mother and daughter did it all. They took a hayride. They hit the petting zoo and fed the goats. They picked apples and ate ice cream and found a clown who dazzled Lily with balloon animals. All around them, hard-working people spent their valuable day off laughing and touching and complaining and arguing and smiling. Maya studied them. She tried to stay in the moment, tried to just disappear into the joy of an autumn day with her daughter, but again, it all felt so elusive, distant, as though she were just observing and not really experiencing it for herself. Her comfort zone was protecting these moments, not participating in them. The hours passed, the day ended, and Maya wasn't sure how she felt about any of it. Sunday night was no better. She tried the new pills, but they did nothing to quiet her ghosts. If anything, the sounds seemed to feed off whatever she was taking, the volume amplified. When she woke up with a sharp gasp, Maya quickly reached for the phone to call Wu. She stopped herself before hitting send. For a moment, she even considered calling Mary McLeod, Judith's colleague, but there was no way she would do that either. Deal with it, Maya. It won't be much longer now. She got dressed, dropped off Lily at Growing Up, and called into work to say that she wouldn't be able to make it.
You can't do this to me, Maya,
Karina Simpson, her boss and fellow former Army pilot, told her.
I'm running a business here. You can't cancel out a lesson at the last minute.
Sorry.
Look, I know you're going through some stuff.
Yeah, Karina, I am, she said, interrupting her. And I think I may have rushed coming back. I'm sorry to leave you high and dry like this, but maybe I just need more time. It was part lie, part truth. She hated looking weak, but this was also necessary. Maya knew now that she wouldn't be coming back to that job. Not ever. 2 hours later, she entered Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, and drove past the trimmed hedges and stone sign reading Franklin Biddle Academy. The sign was small and tasteful, and in the lushness of this fall afternoon, it could easily be missed. That was, of course, the point. As she pulled past the green quad and into the visitor's lot, everything around her screamed pampered, patrician, privileged, powerful. All the peas. Even the campus had a sense of entitlement about it. You could smell the crisp dollar bills more than the fallen leaves there. Money buys seclusion. Money buys fences. Money buys various degrees of insulation. Some money buys the urban world. Some money buys suburban neighborhoods. Some money, big, big money, buys a place like this. We are all just trying to get deeper and deeper into a protective cocoon. The main office was housed in a mainline stone mansion called Windsor House. Maya had decided not to call ahead. She had looked up the headmaster online and figured that she would just surprise him. If he wasn't in, so be it. She would find someone else to talk to about the subject. If he was in, she was sure that he would see her. He was a prep school headmaster, not a head of state. Plus, there was a Burkett dormitory still on campus. Her last name was sure to open most closed doors. The woman at the reception desk spoke in a hushed voice.
May I help you?
Maya Burkett here to see the headmaster. I'm sorry, I don't have an appointment.
Please have a seat.
But it didn't take long. Maya had learned online that the headmaster for the past 23 years was a former graduate and then teacher named Neville Lockwood IV. With a name and pedigree like that, she expected a certain look. Ruddy face, aristocratic features, receding blonde hairline. And she got not only that from the man who greeted her now, but also wrap-around-the-ears wire-rimmed glasses, a tweed jacket, and yes, an Argyle bow tie. He took both her hands in both of his.
Oh, Mrs. Burkett,
Neville Lockwood said, with that accent that again said more about class than geographical location.
All of us here at Franklin Biddle are so sorry about your loss.
Thank you. He started to show her toward his office.
Your husband was one of our most beloved students.
That's kind of you to say. There was a large fireplace stacked with gray logs. To the side was a grandfather clock. Lockwood sat behind his cherrywood desk, offering her the plush chair in front of it. Her chair was set slightly lower than his, and Maya figured that was no accident.
Half the trophies in the Windsor Sports Hall we owe to Joe. He still has the career scoring record in soccer. We were thinking of doing something in memoriam to him in the field house. He loved it so there.
Neville Lockwood gave her a somewhat patronizing smile. Maya returned it. These sports reminiscences could be an entry to an ask for money. Maya wasn't good at picking up on such things. But either way, she decided to push ahead.
Do you know my sister by any chance?
The question surprised him.
Your sister?
Yes, Claire Walker. He considered it for a moment.
The name does ring a bell.
Maya was going to say that Claire had visited here, approximately 4 or 5 months ago, and was then murdered not long after. But something that serious would stun him and probably close him down. Never mind, it's not important. I wanted to ask you some questions about my husband's time here. He folded his hands and waited. She had to tread gently. As you know, Headmaster Lockwood,
please call me Neville.
Neville, she smiled. As you know, this academy is a source of both great pride and tragedy for the Burkett family. He looked appropriately solemn.
You're talking about your husband's brother, I assume?
I am. Neville shook his head.
Such a terrible thing. I know the father passed away a few years back, but poor Judith, losing another son.
Yes, Maya said, taking her time. And I don't know how to raise this exactly, but with Joe dead, well, in terms of this school, that's 3 members of the same soccer team. The color in Neville Lockwood's face started to drain away. I'm talking now about the death of Theo Mora, Maya said. Do you recall that incident? Neville Lockwood found his voice.
Your sister.
What about her?
She came to campus, asking about Theo. That's why the name was familiar. I was off campus at the time, but I heard about it later on.
Confirmation. Maya was on the right track. How did Theo die? She asked. Neville Lockwood looked off.
I could send you away right now, Mrs. Burkett. I could tell you that the school has strict privacy laws and that it would be against school policies to reveal any details.
Maya shook her head. That would be unwise.
Why would you say that?
Because if you don't answer my questions, Maya said, I may have to involve less discreet authorities.
Really?
A small smile toyed with his lips.
And that's supposed to frighten me? Tell me, is this the part where the evil headmaster lies to protect the reputation of his elite institution?
Maya waited.
Well, not me, Captain Stern. Yes, I know your real name. I know all about you. And not unlike the military, this academy has a sacred honor code. I'm surprised Joe didn't tell you about it. Our Quaker roots call for consensus and openness. We don't hide things. The more one knows, we believe, the more one is protected by the truth.
Good, Maya said. So how did Theo die?
I will ask, however, that you respect the family's privacy.
I will.
He sighed. Theo Mora died of alcohol poisoning.
He drank himself to death?
It happens, sadly. Not often. In fact, it was the only time in the history of this campus. But one night, Theo binge drank. He was not known as a partier or anything like that. But that's often how it happens. You don't know what you're doing and you overdo it. Theo probably would have been found and saved in time, except he ended up stumbling into a basement. A custodian found him the next morning. He was already dead. Maya wasn't sure what to make of that. Neville Lockwood put his hands on his desk and leaned forward. Could you tell me why you and your sister are asking about this now? Maya ignored the question. Did you ever wonder, she began, about having two students from the same school and on the same soccer team dying so close together? Yes, Neville Lockwood said. I wondered about it a great deal. Did you ever consider the possibility, Maya continued, that there could be a connection between Theo's death and Andrew's? He leaned back in his chair and steepled his fingers. To the contrary, he said. I don't see how there could not be a connection. That was not the answer Maya had been expecting. Could you elaborate? She asked. I was a math teacher. I taught all kinds of courses in statistics and probabilities. Bivariate data, linear regression, standard deviation, all that stuff. So I look at things as equations and formulas. That's how my mind works. The odds that two students from the same small, elite, all-boys prep school die within months of each other are very slim. The odds that those two boys were in the same grade makes the odds slimmer still. The odds that both played on the same soccer team, well, again, you can start to rule out coincidence. He almost smiled now, raising one finger in the air, lost as though back in the classroom. But when you add the final factor into the equation, the possibility of coincidence is lowered to almost zero.
What final factor? Maya asked.
Theo and Andrew were roommates.
The room fell silent.
The odds that two 17-year-old roommates at a small prep school would both die young and not in some way be related? I confess that I don't believe in odds that long.
In the distance, Maya could hear a church-like bell sound. Doors began to open. Young boys began to laugh.
When Andrew Burkett drowned, Neville Lockwood continued, an investigator came by. Someone from the Coast Guard who dealt with any sort of deaths at sea.
Was his name Tom Douglas?
Could have been. I don't remember anymore. But he came to this very office. He sat right where you are now sitting. And he, too, wanted to know about the possibility of a connection.
Maya swallowed. You told him you saw one.
Yes.
Could you tell me what it is?
Theo's death was a tremendous shock to our community. How it happened was never reported in the papers. The family wanted it that way. But as much as we were all shocked by what happened, Andrew Burkett was Theo's best friend. He was devastated. I assume that you met Joe well after Andrew died, so you didn't know Andrew, did you?
No.
They were very different, the two brothers. Andrew was a far more sensitive boy. He was a sweet child. His coach used to say that was the quality that held Andrew back on the soccer pitch. He didn't have to be victorious in battle like Joe. He lacked the aggression, that competitive edge, that killer instinct that you need in the trenches.
Again, Maya thought, with the inane war metaphors to describe athletics.
There may have been more issues with Andrew, Neville Lockwood added. I really can't say or reveal more, but all that matters for the sake of this discussion was that Andrew took Theo's death very hard. We closed campus for a week after the death. We had counselors at the ready, but most of the boys headed home to, I don't know, recuperate.
How about Andrew and Joe? Maya asked.
They went home too. I remember your mother-in-law rushing down with Andrew's old nanny to pick them up. Anyway, all the boys, including your husband, returned to campus.
All the boys, except one.
Andrew.
Yes.
When did he come back?
Neville Lockwood shook his head.
Andrew Burkett never came back.
His mother felt it best if he took the semester off. Campus life returned to normal. That's how these things are. Joe led the soccer team to a great season. They won their league and were prep school state champions. And after the season ended, Joe took a few of his teammates to celebrate on the family yacht.
Do you know which boys?
I'm not sure. Christopher Swain, for certain. He was co-captain with Joe. I don't remember who else. Anyway, you wanted to know about the connection. I think it's obvious now, but here is my hypothesis. We have a sensitive boy whose best friend tragically dies. The boy is forced to leave school and perhaps, theoretically, has to deal with depression issues. Perhaps, again, theoretically, the boy has to take antidepressants or other mood-altering drugs. He is then sailing on a yacht with people who remind him of both this tragedy and what he missed and loved about campus life. There is a raucous party on board. The boy has too much to drink, which mixes badly with whatever medications he might be taking. He's on the boat in the middle of the water. He goes up to the top deck and looks out at the ocean. He's in tremendous pain. Neville Lockwood stopped there.
You think Andrew committed suicide? Maya said.
Perhaps. It's a theory. Or perhaps the mix of alcohol and medications caused a loss of equilibrium and he fell over. Either way, the proof, if you will, is the same. Theo's death directly led to Andrew's. The most likely hypothesis is that the two deaths are thus connected. Maya just sat there. So now, he said, that I've told you my theory, perhaps you can tell me why this is relevant today.
One more question, if I may.
He nodded for her to go ahead.
If two deaths from the same team are that unlikely, how do you explain three?
Three? I'm not following.
I'm talking about Joe.
He frowned. He died, what, 17 years later?
Still, you're the probability guy. What are the odds that his death isn't somehow connected?
Are you saying that your husband's murder is somehow related to Theo and Andrew?
Seems to me, Maya said, like you already said it.
Chapter 25. There was nothing more to learn. Neville Lockwood walked her out a few minutes later. Maya sat in her car for a moment. Up ahead was the storied landmark of Franklin Biddle, an 8-story Anglican bell tower. The 4 notes of the Westminster chimes sounded again. Maya checked her watch. They went on the quarter hour, she assumed. She took out her phone and started Googling again. Theo Mora's parents were named Javier and Raisa. She started searching White Pages sites to see if they lived in the area. She found a Raisa Mora within the Philadelphia city limits. It was worth a try. Her cell phone rang. The caller ID for Leather and Lace popped up. She lifted the phone to her ear, but of course, whoever was on the other end had already hung up. The signal that Corey needed to see her. Well, she was a solid 2 hours away, and she had other places to be. Corey would just have to wait. Raisa Mora's street was packed with seen better days row houses. Maya found the right address and headed up steps of cracked concrete. She pressed the buzzer, listened for footsteps, heard nothing. Smashed bottles lined the walk. 2 doors down, a man in an open flannel shirt over a wife beater tee gave her a toothless smile. They were a long way from those Westminster chimes.
Maya pulled open the screen door. It opened with a rusty groan. She knocked hard.
"Who is it?"
a woman from inside called out.
"My name is Maya Stern." "What do you want?"
"Are you Raisa Mora?"
"What do you want?"
"I want to ask you about your son, Theo." The door flung open. Raisa Mora wore a diner waitress uniform of faded mustard. Her mascara was smeared. There was more gray than black in the hair bun. She wore socks, and Maya could imagine that she had just come from some too long work shift and kicked her shoes into a corner.
"Who are you?"
"My name is Maya Stern." Then, thinking better of it, she added, "Burkett." That last name got her attention.
"You're Joe's wife."
"Yes."
"You're a soldier, right?"
"Former," Maya said. "Do you mind if I come in?" Raisa crossed her arms and leaned against the doorframe.
"What do you want?"
"I want to ask about your son Theo's death."
"Why would you want to know about that?"
"Please, Mrs. Mora, you have every reason to ask me, but I really don't have time to explain it all. Let me just say this. I'm not sure we know all there is to know about your son's death." Raisa stared at her for several seconds.
"Your husband was murdered recently. I saw that in the paper."
"Yes."
"They picked up two suspects."
"Saw that too." "They're innocent," Maya said.
"I don't understand."
The facade didn't so much crack as give way just enough for a tear to appear.
"You think, what, Joe's murder has something to do with my Theo?"
"I don't know," Maya said as gently as she could. "But is there any harm in just answering my questions?" Raisa kept her arms crossed.
"What do you want to know?"
"Everything."
"Come on in then. I'm going to need to sit down."
The two women sat together on a threadbare couch that had clearly seen better days, but then again so had the rest of the room. Raisa handed Maya a framed family photograph. The hues had been faded by age or too much sun, or more likely both. 5 people were in the picture. Maya recognized Theo with 2 smaller boys who she assumed were his brothers. Behind the 3 children stood Raisa, looking not all that much younger, though a hell of a lot happier, and a stocky man with a big mustache and wide smile.
"That's Javier," Raisa said, pointing to the man. "Theo's father. He passed away 2 years after Theo died. Cancer. That's what they say. But..."
Javier had a good smile, the kind you could feel even in a photograph, the kind that made you wonder what his laugh sounded like. Raisa took the photograph back from Maya and gingerly placed it back on the shelf.
"Javier came here from Mexico. I was a poor girl living in San Antonio. We met and..." "You don't need to hear this."
"No, go ahead."
"Doesn't matter," Raisa said. "We ended up in Philadelphia because Javier had a cousin who got him a job doing landscaping. You know, mowing lawns for rich people, that kind of thing. But Javier..."
She stopped, smiled at some memory.
"He was smart, ambitious, really personable too. Everybody liked Javier. He had that way about him, you know what I mean? Some people, they're just kind of magic. They draw people to them. My Javier was one of them."
Maya nodded toward the photograph.
"I can see that." "You can, right?"
Her smile faded away.
"Anyway, Javier did a lot of work for the families on the main line, including the Lockwood family."
"As in the headmaster?"
"His cousin, actually. Super rich financial guy. He mostly lived in New York, but he kept an estate out here, too. Snootiest looking man you ever met, with his blonde hair and jutted jaw and all that. But he was kind, too. He liked Javier. The men started talking a lot. One day, Javier told him about Theo."
The pain came back to her face all at once.
"He was such a special boy, my Theo. So smart. Great athlete. Really had it all, as they say. Like all parents, we wanted a better life for him. Javier, he wanted to get Theo into a better school. Turns out Franklin Beadle Academy was looking to get a few scholarship kids in, you know, financial aid, so they could say that the school was, she made quote marks with her hands, diverse. So this Lockwood guy wanted to help. He talked to his cousin, the headmaster, and next thing you know, have you been to the school?
Yes.
Ridiculous, right?
I guess.
But Javier was so happy when Theo got in. Me, I was worried for Theo. How do you fit in at a place like that when you come from a place like this? It's almost like, I don't know, what do they call it when scuba divers come up too fast? The bends. It felt like that to me. I didn't say anything, though. I'm not stupid. I could see what an opportunity this could be for Theo, you know what I mean?
Yes, of course.
So one morning, Javier goes off to work.
Raisa Mora clasped her hands as though in desperate prayer, and Maya figured that they were getting close.
Me? I got the late shift at work, so I was home.
The doorbell rings. Her gaze traveled in that direction.
They don't call. They ring the doorbell, you know, like Theo was in the army or something. It's Headmaster Lockwood and some other school official, I don't remember his name. They're just standing there, and I see their faces, and you'd think I would know, right? You'd think I would see them standing there with their eyes down and looking all sad, and that I'd get it right away, and then I'd collapse onto the ground screaming, no, no. But it wasn't that way at all. I smiled at them, said, well, this is a nice surprise. Showed them in, asked them if I could get them some coffee, and then she almost smiled. You want to hear something awful?
Maya thought that she already had. What could be more awful? But she nodded.
I found out later that they actually taped everything they said to me. Lawyer's advice or something. They actually had a tape recorder going the whole time they're telling me how my boy's body was found by some custodian in the basement. I didn't get it.
Custodian? I said. They said his name, like that would matter.
Theo had too much to drink, they told me. Like an overdose with alcohol. I said, Theo doesn't drink. And they nodded like that made perfect sense, that it's always the boys who don't know what they're doing who end up drinking too much and dying. They said normally a kid can be saved when this happens, but Theo stumbled around and ended up in a corner of the basement. No one saw him until the next day. By then it was too late. Same thing almost word for word that Neville Lockwood had told her. It was starting to sound practiced, rehearsed.
Was an autopsy done? Maya asked.
Yes. Javier and me, we met with the coroner ourselves. Nice woman. We sat in her office and she told us it was alcohol poisoning. I guess a lot of boys got drunk that night. Some kind of party that got out of control. But Javier, he didn't believe it.
What did he think happened?
He didn't know. He thought maybe someone pressured Theo, you know? New kid in school, poor kid, so the rich kids pressured him and he drank too much. He wanted to make a big stink about it.
And you?
I didn't see the point, she said with an exhausted shrug. Even if that was true, it wouldn't bring Theo back, would it? And that's what happens everywhere, doesn't it? Kids in this neighborhood get pressured too, so what was the point? And then, I know it's wrong, but then there's the money to consider.
Maya got what she meant. The school made a financial offer.
You see these other two boys in the picture?
She wiped the tears from her eyes and stuck out her chest.
That's Melvin. He's now a professor at Stanford. A professor, and he's barely 30 years old. And Johnny is in medical school at Johns Hopkins. The academy made sure that our boys never had to pay for their education. Gave Javier and me some money, too. But we just put it in accounts for the children.
Mrs. Mora, do you remember Theo's roommate at Franklin Biddle?
You mean Andrew Burkett?
Yes.
He would have been what? Your brother-in-law?
The poor boy. You remember him then?
Of course. They all came to Theo's funeral. All these handsome, rich-looking boys with their blue blazers and school ties and wavy hair. all dressed exactly the same, all lining up to say my condolences like rich boy robots. But Andrew, he was different.
How so?
He was sad. Really, really sad. He wasn't just, I don't know, going through the motions.
Were they close, Andrew and Theo?
I think so, yes. Theo said Andrew was his best friend. When Andrew fell off that boat not long after, I mean, I read it was an accident. But that didn't make sense to me. The poor boy loses his best friend, and then he falls off a boat?
She looked up at Maya with an arched eyebrow.
It wasn't an accident, was it?
Maya said.
I don't think so. No. Javier suspected that. We went to Andrew's funeral, did you know that?
No, I didn't.
I remembered saying to Javier, Andrew seemed so sad about Theo. I wondered if grief killed him, you know what I mean? Like he was so sad that he ended up maybe jumping off that boat?
Maya nodded. But Javier didn't believe that.
What did he believe?
Raisa looked down at her clasped hands.
Javier said to me, grief don't do that to a man. Guilt does.
There was silence.
See, Javier, he couldn't handle what happened. The settlement? He said it was blood money. I didn't see that. Like I said, maybe those rich boys had pushed Theo a bit, but in the end, I mean, I'd always thought the reason Javier went so crazy was because he blamed himself. He was the one who pushed Theo to go to a school where he didn't belong. And God help me, I blamed him too. I tried to hide it, but I think Javier could always see it on my face. Even when he got sick. Even when I nursed him. Even when he lay in his bed and held my hand and died. Javier saw that look on my face. Maybe it was even the last thing he ever saw.
She lifted her head, wiped a tear with her index finger.
So maybe Javier was right. Maybe it wasn't grief that killed Andrew Burkett. Maybe it was guilt.
They sat there for a few moments. Maya reached out and took Raisa's hand. It wasn't like her. It wasn't a gesture Maya often made, but it felt right. After some time had passed, Raisa said,
Your husband was murdered a few weeks ago.
Yes.
And now you're here.
Maya nodded.
That's not a coincidence, is it?
No, Maya said. It's not.
Who killed my boy, Mrs. Burkett? Who murdered my Theo?
Maya told Raisa Mora that she didn't know the answer. But she was starting to think that maybe she did. Chapter 26. When Maya got back in her car, she just stared out the front windshield for a little while. She wanted so much to lower her head and cry. But there was no time. She checked her phone. Two more hang-ups from Leather and Lace. They must be getting desperate. Maya decided to break protocol. She called the number back and asked for Lulu.
May I help you?
Lulu asked. Enough with the cloak and dagger. I'm in Philadelphia.
One of our best girls got sick, so we have an opening for you to dance tonight. If you want the job, it's urgent that you come in.
Maya held back the eye roll. I'll be there. Using her smartphone, she Googled Christopher Swain, the soccer team co-captain who had been on the yacht that night. He worked in Manhattan for the aptly named Swain Real Estate. The family had tons of holdings in all five boroughs of New York City. Great. More super wealth to navigate. She found an email address for him on the Franklin Biddle alumni page and sent him a short message. My name is Maya Burkett. My husband was Joe. It is urgent that we speak. Please contact me as soon as you can. She included all her contact information. 2 hours later, Maya pulled into Leather and Lace and parked in the employee lot. She started to get out of her car when the passenger door opened and Corey slipped inside and ducked down.
Drive, he whispered.
Maya didn't hesitate. She put the car in reverse and was out of the lot in a matter of seconds. What's wrong? She asked when they reached the road.
We need to take a ride.
Where? He gave her an address in Livingston off Route 10. Livingston, Maya said. I assume this has something to do with Tom Douglas? Corey kept looking behind him. We aren't being tailed, she said.
You're sure?
Yes.
I needed to get out of there. I don't want them to know.
Maya didn't ask why. It wasn't her concern. So where are we going?
I've been tracking Tom Douglas's emails.
You personally? In the corner of her eye, she saw him smile.
You probably think I have a big staff.
I know you have a lot of followers, seems too weak a word, more like they worship you.
Until they don't. I can't trust them. I'm just the new cause celeb. People get distracted easily. Remember Coney 2012? So yes, I do most of it myself.
Maya tried to get him back on track. And you were following Tom Douglas's emails?
Right. He still uses AOL, if you can believe it. The guy is four steps behind old school. He does very little by email. Not one has been read or sent in almost a month.
Maya veered to the right and got on the highway, which is when his wife says he vanished.
Exactly. So earlier today, Douglas got an email from a guy named Julian Rubenstein for an unpaid bill. From what I gather from the email, Rubenstein rents Douglas his storage shed behind a body shop in Livingston.
A car body shop?
I guess so, yeah.
Weird spot for a storage shed, she said.
There's no automatic payment by credit card, no paperwork, nothing like that. He pays the guy in cash.
Trying to keep it all off the books, Maya thought.
So I guess Douglas missed his last payment, Corey said. That's why Julian Rubenstein emailed him a reminder. It was all friendly, like, hey, Tom, long time no see, you're behind, that kind of thing.
Maya's hands tightened on the wheel. This sounded like something. You have a plan? Corey lifted a gym bag into view.
Ski masks, two flashlights, a chain cutter.
We could just ask his wife for access.
If she has the right to give it to us, he said. And what if she says no?
He had a point.
There's something else, Maya.
She didn't like the tone.
I didn't lie, but you need to understand, I had to test your loyalty.
Uh-huh, Maya said. They stopped at a red light. Maya turned to him and waited.
I didn't tell you everything.
So tell me now, she said.
Your sister.
What about her?
She sent me more material on EAC Pharmaceuticals than I told you about.
Maya nodded. Yeah, I figured that.
How?
There was no reason to tell him everything either.
You knew the Burkettes were up to something illegal, but you didn't have anything specific. That's what you said at first. Then you pointed out about EAC Pharmaceuticals. I figured that she had to have given you more. Right. But see, what she gave us still wasn't enough. We could leak what we had, but if we did, well, there would be time to sweep it under the rug. It was too early in the investigation to tip our hands. We needed more.
So Claire kept digging.
Yes.
And she found Tom Douglas.
Right. Except Claire said that he had nothing to do with EAC Pharmaceuticals. It was something else, something bigger.
The light turned green. Maya eased on the accelerator. Once Claire was killed, why didn't you at least release what she gave you?
Like I said, it wasn't really enough. But more than that, I wanted to figure out the Tom Douglas connection. Claire seemed more concerned with that than the fake drugs, frankly. So if we revealed what I knew, I worried that they would just cover it all up. I wanted to find out more.
So with Claire dead, Maya said, you got me to start digging. He didn't argue the point.
You're something, Corey. I'm manipulative, I admit.
That's a polite word for what you are.
It's for a just cause.
Right. So why are you telling me now?
Because someone died from the fake drugs.
a 3-year-old boy in India. He had a fever from an infection. They started treating him with EAC's version of amoxicillin. It didn't do anything. By the time the doctor switched antibiotics, it was too late. The boy went into a coma and died.
Horrible, Maya said. How did you find out about it?
Someone at the hospital. An anonymous physician wants to turn whistleblower. He kept detailed charts, made audio and visual recordings, even saved some tissue samples. That, along with what Claire told me, it's still not enough, Maya. The Burkettes will blame the Indians running the pharmaceutical companies. They'll hide behind expensive lawyers who know how to muddy the waters. It may wound them a little. It may cost them millions, maybe hundreds of millions. But
you think Tom Douglas is their kryptonite?
I do, yeah.
There was a lilt in his voice now.
Claire thought so, too.
You're enjoying this, Maya said.
Didn't you sometimes enjoy combat?
She didn't answer.
It doesn't mean I don't take it seriously. But yeah, I get excited.
Maya signaled right and made the turn. Was that how you felt when you got my helicopter video?
Excited? Truth? Yes.
They fell into silence. Maya drove. Corey fiddled with the radio. After about half an hour, they took the exit off Eisenhower Parkway. The GPS said they were less than a mile away.
Maya?
Yes?
You're still friends with a lot of your military pals. Shane Tessier, for one.
You keeping tabs on me?
Some.
What's your point, Corey?
Do any of them know what's on the audio of that helicopter? I mean,
I know what you mean, she snapped. Then,
no.
He was about to ask a follow-up, but Maya stopped him with, we're here. When she made the left turn onto a dirt road, her eyes started scanning the area for surveillance cameras. None present. She pulled the car to a stop a block away from JR's body shop. Corey handed her the ski mask. She shook her head. We'll be less obvious without them. It's dark. We are a couple looking for our car after hours or something.
I need to be extra careful, he said.
I know.
I can't be spotted.
You got the facial growth. You got the baseball cap. You'll be fine. Grab the chain cutter and keep your head down. He looked doubtful.
Or wait here and I'll do it.
She opened the car door and got out. Corey didn't like it, but he grabbed the chain cutter and followed. They walked in silence. It was dark now, but Maya didn't turn on the flashlight. She kept scanning her surroundings. No cameras. No security. No houses. Interesting, Maya said.
What?
Tom Douglas chose here to rent a storage unit.
What do you mean?
There's a CubeSmart storage right down the street. A public storage, too. They have security cameras and easy access and all that. But Tom Douglas didn't choose there.
Because he's old school.
Could be, Maya said. Or it could be that he really didn't want anyone to know about this. Think about it. You hacked into his credit cards. If he was paying by check or credit card at a normal storage facility center, you'd probably have found some record of it. He clearly didn't want that. JR's body shop was made of concrete painted the yellow of a Ticonderoga pencil. The two garage bay doors were shut. Maya could see the padlocks, even at a distance. The grass hadn't been mowed in a long while, if ever. There were rusted car parts scattered across the property. Maya and Corey circled toward the back. A vehicle graveyard blocked their path. Maya spotted a beaten-down, once white, Oldsmobile Cutlass Sierra from the mid-90s, the same car her dad had once owned, and for a moment she flashed back to that day. Dad turning the corner, all of them waiting, Dad honking his horn, that crooked smile on his face. Mom hopping in the front, Claire and Maya sliding into the back. It wasn't a flashy car, far from it, but Dad loved it, and Maya couldn't help, stupid as it felt, looking at this Oldsmobile and wondering whether it was the exact one that had made her dad so happy on that day.
how every vehicle in this pile of junk had one day been driven off the lot, new and shiny, with excitement and hope and expectation, and now they lay in tatters, dying piece by piece in the back lot of an old body shop off Route 10.
"You okay?" Corey asked.
She moved ahead without replying. She flicked on her flashlight. The yard had to be 2, maybe 3 acres, and in the back right-hand corner, almost hidden from view by an old Chevy van, Maya spotted 2 outdoor sheds, the kind people buy at Home Depot or Lowe's to store their shovels and rakes and gardening stuff. She pointed at them with the flashlight beam. Corey squinted and then nodded. They started to move closer in silence, high-stepping it over the hubcaps and engine parts and car doors that littered their path. The sheds were small, maybe 4 feet high and 4 feet wide. Maya guessed that they were made from resin or some other sort of heavy-duty, all-weather plastic. These were the kind of units you assembled yourself in about an hour. Both units were padlocked closed. They kept moving, but when they were about 10 yards away, both Maya and Corey pulled up from the smell at the exact same moment. With mounting horror on his face, Corey looked at Maya. Maya just nodded.
"Oh no," Corey said.
Corey wanted to turn and run right then and there.
"Don't," Maya said.
Corey stopped. "It'll be worse if we run," she said.
"We don't even know what that smell is. It could be an animal."
"Could be."
"So we just leave now."
"You leave, Corey."
"What?"
"I'm staying. I'm opening it. I can handle the blowback."
"You can't. I get that. You're already a wanted man, so go. I won't tell anyone you've been here." "What will you tell them?"
"Don't worry about it. Go."
"I'll want to know what you found."
Maya had had enough with the indecision.
"Then hang around another minute."
The chain cutter sliced through the padlock like a hot knife through butter. When the door flew open, a human arm popped out.
"Oh, God,"
Corey said. The smell made him gag, step back, and start to dry heave.